projects, and we're going to move to our second local project, which is the Warmington Heritage Group. And Liz Newman, who's the secretary, is going to be presenting their project.
Yes, we are moving very much. I'm very much aware that we have had a county project followed by a diocesan project, and we are now coming down to the minutiae of a small parish in the extreme south of the county, in the extreme south of the diocese as well. I'd just like to pass around a few pieces of paper. This is actually not about this project, but it is just to show you that we are not completely insular or parochial, but have wider interests. The Grove Farm project was a collaborative piece of work undertaken 5 years ago by half a dozen members of the Warmington Heritage Group in response to an invitation from the Warwickshire Record Offices to undertake the history of a building within the county, researching archival material. Our research included not only the farmhouse, but also the people who owned it or tenanted it, and the history of its extensive farmlands. So, where is Warmington? Warwickshire was long thought of as a county divided between the Arden of the north and west and the Feldon of the south and east. But there is a distinct sub-region of the Feldon, 16 or more parishes, and I had hoped I'd have one of these little light things that would show. So we have something here called the Cotswold Fringe. And this is the area that we're talking about. And right up to, and including that part there, Warmington is a parish that lies just there. Shotswell is the one that falls off to the bottom of the county there. And where the next one, Warmington is just there. So there are this distinct sub-region, called here the Cotswold Fringe, is 16 or more parishes running along the southeast boundary of the county where the land rises to 600 or 700 feet along the watershed. It drains to the Cherwell, which runs pretty well due south there. It's the watershed, and then you have streams running. Oops, there's the River Stour, the River Dean, or as it used to no doubt be called at one time, the Wellesbourne, and the, what's that one called? That's the Leam, isn't it, going up there? So it is, this area is on the watershed between these two great river sources. One, Cherwell drains into the Thames, and the others all drain into there's a Severn eventually. These parishes have land on the lower Lyas clays, which is typical of the Feldon, but they also rise quite steeply in places to the redlands, the plateau lands, where the ironstone, which is what you're seeing there, the higher land, the ironstone is close to the surface. In the days before the enclosure of the open fields, these different soils within each of these communities helped families survive even in years of poor harvest. And to the north and west of these settlements, you know where I mean anyway, that to the north and west, there lie a marked band of settlements which contracted or failed in the later medieval period, leaving these villages on the fringe without a vibrant economic hinterland. Many of these villages turned to the market town of Banbury in Oxfordshire, only 5 or 6 miles away from Warmington. This map shows Banbury at the centre of an area. Can you spot it? Mm-hmm. Do I need to highlight it? In the centre of the area, you've probably got a better view of it than I have. Have I got it right there? Mm-hmm. Is that Banbury? In the centre of an area where this ironstone or marlstone was the predominant building material. On the highest lands, it outcropped and was easily obtainable. The stone foundations would have been the norm for all but the poorest dwellings, even when timber and wattland daub was used above, and straw thatch was the normal roofing material, except for stone slates on the biggest buildings. The Banbury area is a classic case of Hoskins' great rebuilding, both before and after the Civil War. Wood Jones first published his book on the traditional domestic architecture of the Banbury region in 1963. This is the cover from the second edition, and he was the first to study the area in depth. As far as I know, he was the only one really to study the architecture in such depth. It is an admirable publication. This reprint of 1986 shows the salient features of the yeoman farmhouse, the ones recorded in the hearth tax of the 1660s with three or four hearths. A thatched building, three unit plan with cross passage, two and a half stories, the floors are stone flagged or beaten earth. There's a winder stair, they're just visible, I think, going up to the dark attics and down to a cellar, which would extend over underneath part of the house. The stone mullion windows of two, three, or possibly four lights, rarely symmetrically placed, and the decoration would be the label moulding around the mullion windows and doorways. This homogeneity of style of building throughout the Banbury region was the one in which the people of Warmington would feel at home. This is a copy from that book of Warmington Manor House, which is a splendid Elizabethan manor house and still survives pretty well intact. Now, although built on a grander scale with east and west wings, you can see there, east and west wings, it's still basically a large hall three with a through passage, and it's not very, very different, although on a slightly grander scale, but it owes much to the vernacular idiom of the Banbury area. So we get round to what we're come to talk about. This is Grove Farmhouse, the rear south elevation. It's built 1699 or 1700, as we were to discover. It's well documented, built by the Claridge family, bought by William Holbeach of Farnborough in 1785 to add to his adjoining Farnborough estate, and it was tenanted for long periods. It was sold to its sitting tenant in 1950 and currently is being lovingly restored. It intrigued us because it was a substantial farmhouse, but it was not built in the local vernacular style. Here we see it looking north to the Avondasset and the Undasset hills in the background there. I think you can just spot Avondasset Church, possibly there, and through to Burton Dasset, which is going away from us. Now, this is the same picture. Oh, I see, I've got it there. I don't need to keep craning over there, do I? This is the same in close-up. Note the symmetrical disposition of the windows. They're disturbed only to light the fine staircase in the centre there, which sweeps up in six half-lights from the ground floor to the attics. The cellar, which is a semi-basement, you can see one mullion window down at the bottom there. One stone mullion window, which is to light the basements, lit for stone mullion for strength, really. And the other windows all have wooden transoms, the forerunner of the sash. Notice particularly, because this is a fairly rare photograph, notice particularly the two massive chimney stacks, which were extended upwards with blue bricks in the 19th century, but the hollow between the stacks. This houses a lead flat. On this, the rainwater collects and drains through an external pipe to guttering on the east side. So there is a dip down there with a lead flat underneath it, which of course you can't see, and then the water drains through and comes to this guttering here. This is the other elevation, the north elevation, and that's from the 1950s sales catalogue when the Farnborough estate was split up. Here you see the regular fenestration, the flight of steps to the main door because the house is built into the slope. And we move on to the Claridge family tree. Who were the people who built this innovative house? In the Warmington housing stock, it is a definite foreigner. In the countryside, as a farmhouse, it was one that was a forerunner of many that were built in later decades, but surely a pioneer in 1700. So going through the family quickly, William I was the yeoman of Tysoe. He bought the first family's first land in Warmington with a house and cottage, and his son Richard I added to the land holding. His children included a Mary, who married a prosperous Banbury man, William Wakeley. His heir was William II, who lived in the family home. He was taxed on three hearths in 1670, and we shall have a picture of his house in a moment. He had two sons by an early marriage and a third son by a later marriage. And this was one of the sort of serendipity things about this project. We were able to discover quite a lot about Richard II, 1650 to 1728. He was well educated. He became an Anglican clergyman. He buried his first wife in Warmington, and the memorial was recorded by Dugdale in Dr. Thomas's edition of Dugdale, that is, in the 1730s. Richard II resigned his benefice in 1691 at the age of 41, and he briefly joined the Baptists before becoming a Quaker. His name is often linked with George Fox, or it was, in publications, and tracing his life story through his writings, and visited Aylesbury, for instance, and using the internet, his extensive correspondence to families and Quaker settlers in the USA are fascinating, but he was also of inestimable value to the Quakers in those early dangerous years, and his knowledge of Anglican doctrine obviously was very useful when the Quakers were attacked. And his uncle Wakeley, see him up there, that one there, as an alderman and mayor and magistrate of Banbury, and his son as well, in other words, Richard's uncle and cousin, both persecuted the Quakers. It was indeed a time when the world was turned upside down. Richard II obviously inherited the farm, but he inherited the farm, but he was not going to be a farmer in Warmington. Looking at their watches, which is very disconcerting. He sold his farm to his younger half-brother, William III, who had inherited most of his father's personal estate, and at the early age of 26, he was responsible for building the farmhouse we see today. His father's inventory of 1697 shows that, like other relatively prosperous yeoman farmers in the village, the family was running a mixed farm, but at twice the normal average scale. As well, he had other land outside the village for stock, and he was producing surpluses for the market. The scale of the farming business had outgrown the accommodation provided by the old farmhouse. So William III built the house to reflect his social aspirations. We'll see in a moment how he did that. But just going on with the family, 10 years on, disaster struck. William III died at the age of 37, leaving a widow, who lived on for 32 years, entitled to her widow's portion, which was drain on the estate, and he left six very young children. His will made lavish provision, perhaps over-lavish provision, for them all. The estate was leased out, and widow Isabel moved with her children to Banbury. William IV, died at an even earlier date, age at 27. And in 1733, before he had fully implemented his father's will. Now, 40 years on, William V bought further small parcels of land in the open field in the run-up to the enclosure of the open field in 1777. With two other absentee landowners, he saw the private act of enclosure through Parliament. This was a time of great anxiety. A recent publication by William Hawkes, The Diaries of Sanderson Miller, 20 years earlier, but it shows the great anxieties experienced by somebody who was deeply involved in the enclosure of the open fields. There's an enormous anxiety attached to this process, and it took several years before a landowner could expect to reap the benefits of enclosure. But William V did not survive this sort of economic hurdle. Within 6 years, by 1783, we find he was imprisoned for debt. Whilst he was in prison, a disastrous fire destroyed some of his home buildings, causing £442, 15 shillings worth of damage, according to the quarter session records of midsummer 1783. He was given a letter of license to solicit charity. As he was then a prisoner, the license was extended to a friend, and at Michaelmas, the license was re-granted, as few collections had been made. That's all according to Philip Styles. And according to Philip Styles, this license was in fact the last ever issued in the county. In 1785, the farm and house were sold through an intermediary to William Holbeach of Farnborough. So William VI, who was to die childless, had to attend to the family's financial affairs after his father died intestate. And he managed to retain the small house next door to Grove Farm. And it's significant that he reverted to the title of yeoman in his will. These tombs, and we are back to the churchyard, these tombs record the Claridge dynasty. I love this one because can you see the cherubs modestly draped? And there's another one that shows the tools of the sexton's trade, the familiar mortality symbols of that period. And there are the two table tombs. They stand at the southeast corner of the church, close to the chancel. This is the barn, used as a barn for about 300 years, I suppose. It clearly was domestic. We believe that it was the Claridge home before the rebuilding of 1700. You can see from the steep pitch of the roof and from the gable parapet that it was formerly thatched, although difficult to detect. I think it does have a mullion window in that that must be somewhere down there in that wall, and that one there I think is a stone mullion as well. So we'll move on to the house itself. And this was drawings of the house plans undertaken by one of our members. This is the front elevation, and it shows a house with these two enormous chimney stacks towering up, and the floor, you can see, is actually the floor beams are actually the chimney stack is used as support for the floor beams. It's a a very early example of a full double-depth farmhouse, built with a hipped roof about a central lead flat, which overcame the problems of the more usual valley gutter. The design is a departure from the traditional vernacular style of the Banbury area. It seems likely that the local craftsmen, the Warmington craftsmen in the surrounding area, had learned additional skills while working in Warwick during the swift rebuilding of the town after the fire of 1694. Skilled workers were in demand there for a time, regardless of whether they were freemen of the borough. In other respects, too, the house was of innovative design. The weight of the building is carried not just on its external walls, but also on these two great chimney stacks, which form an important part of its foundation. Few of the internal walls, there you see the lead. Few of the internal walls are load-bearing. The house made more economical use of stone than the traditional one-room wide house, while the timber used in construction of floors and roofs needed to be no more than what was used in houses of the vernacular style. The house was innovative in design, economical in construction, and highly functional to accommodate an expanding farming business. The new house made a clear statement that its owner had shed the yeoman status of his forebears, and in future he would be included among the gentry. So I think you can see that you have four rooms on each floor of more or less equal size. Here that we have a small yard with the conveniently placed to the back door with the pump, and the well is actually just off the picture to the right. Here are the two doors, one leading into the back door leading into the kitchen, the door leading down in from the yard into the cellar. So we'll walk through the house quickly, starting with the cellars. And I'm not sure that I've necessarily got these in the correct order. The four square double piled house provides four main rooms on each of the four floors. The two great chimney stacks take up, while providing versatility, also provided spaces around the stacks which could provide generous passageways or be partitioned to provide small rooms. And yet, the style deterred major remodeling. Through much of its 300-year history, the house has been tenanted, again, a discouragement to drastic change. So the side door led down five steps into the semi-basement. The dairy was on the northwest corner, the coolest position, traditional coolest position. Brick piers would have supported a stone worktop, a normal dairy feature. Another room has a similar drain to that one. These are two different rooms in the cellar. And it was presumably designed as a sort of food processing room, for example, cutting up meat, salting it in brine, or preparing it for smoking. The third of the well-lit rooms has a large open hearth with oven and a recess for keeping salt, an important commodity. It also houses a copper and sink. And those, we have two or three of these ovens still existing. Right, I've been asked to finish, so I'll leave it at that. Sorry. Thank you.
Well, right. Sorry, that's absolutely fascinating. And I've really enjoyed that spotlight and showing how an individual place and story also has such national resonance and also obviously relationship to parish churches.
Now, how does one start such a project? I mean, what was the original impetus to start it? Was it, did it come from an owner of this property, or was it the group's interest that kicked this off? And was, were there problems of access and things like that, your practicalities? Did you find it was easy to do the work that you wanted to do?
The record offices in Warwickshire, the Warwick Record Office and the Stratford-on-Avon office, issued a competition. And the Warmington Heritage Group has been in existence now for 15 years, so it would then be in existence for the best part of 10, I suppose. And we thought, well, shall we have a go at this competition? And we are a research organisation. We take our work quite seriously, I think. And we had already looked at this particular house. Dr. Nat Alcock has worked on it, as we were subsequently to discover. A man called Arthur Oswald remarkably produced a very erudite article on this particular house in Country Life, would you believe, back in 1950. So it had been looked at before. What was your second question?
Practicalities of it. Do you find it easy to, you know...
We had enormous cooperation from the present owners. The farmland was pretty well split from the house itself in, when would it be, 10 years ago?
2000.
Half of it. The upper, I didn't really have time to talk about this, but the upper land is now the National Herd Centre. The land lower down was still kept for agricultural purposes, but sold off separately.
Yes,
I mean, even had I finished what I was talking about, it was really only covering the first part. We went on and talked about, researched the tenants of the land and the land use. And it is amazing what quantity of detail one can find. We had reference to all sorts of surveys, land tax, parish registers, the MAF survey, Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries survey of, wait a minute, that's the Second World War.
1940.
But also the reassessment under the 1910 Finance Act, when all farm property was, all property was reassessed. And this is a wonderful resource which is probably very little used. Okay, yes, there's some records in Warwick. If you want the detail, you've got to go to Kew. But there is a wealth of material out there for studying something in the minute detail. But we also have the spin-off from this project that didn't have time to talk about, but you'll find on the boards. Wallpaper, five layers of wallpaper on this, what had been tenanted for so many, many years. Took that to the Victoria and Albert, having taken it to Warwick and then on. So, wallpaper, that's a fascinating subject. We have samples here from 1840, 1860s, 1890s probably. The Quaker spin-off, researching his life and the Quaker involvement in the area. That was fascinating. We walked the farmlands and we discovered prehistoric flints and loads of Roman pottery. So this has taken our heritage group from being a purely local history group to being an archaeological group as well, and we have discovered important Roman buildings on this farmland. And we hope to continue with that. We are still looking for the Anglo-Saxon and not yet found it in any quantity. So a project like this helps the group to focus for a time. It also has these unexpected spin-offs.